say.
And he's going to talk today about entanglement detection with bounded reference frames.
Okay, thank you very much, Federico, for the presentation, and thank you for everybody for inviting me here. And so, what I will talk today about is related to a topic that seems quite a lot of interest recently, topic of reference frames, and interest from different areas and different point of view, because it's something that sometimes is seen as a typical quantum information subject, sometimes it's more foundational, and there are also some people in that want to apply this to quantum gravity, so it's quite an interesting topic. So generally, well, we know that reference frames are pretty important in physics, because whenever you write down a state, I usually refer at least implicitly to some reference frame. And one always wants to ask how these reference frames are important and how are just some additional tool that you are using. So if it is possible to phrase everything you're saying without some reference frame or not. So this is, as you know, typical approach of special relativity, general relativity. One wants to get rid of external reference frame and only speak about relative quantities. The quite new idea is what if the reference frame itself is a quantum object? So very generally, you can think a reference frame as some array, for example, or some set of material object with respect to which we measure relative positions, angles, and velocities. But if these are physical objects, these will be finally subject to the laws of quantum mechanics. And so, is it possible to really consider a situation where reference frames are quantum objects? And if so, what are the implications of this? So, in this talk, I will first give a brief review of the recent work that has been done on this subject. And then the main topic will be how the use of a quantum reference frame affects tests of quantum mechanics. And with tests of quantum mechanics, we mean typically violation of Bell inequality. So if you have a quantum system, you can have entanglement in it, and you can test this entanglement by violating some Bell inequalities or some other kind of inequalities, we will see. And usually, one always assumes the presence of a perfect reference frame, of course, because this is always in quantum mechanics. So what we want to know is if using quantum reference frame instead makes some difference. So the very general intuition is that if you have a quantum reference frame, the information that it can contain is less. And so you will not be able to specify your state with perfect precision. And so we expect that also you will not be able to see quantum phenomena with arbitrary small reference frames. I will talk a little bit also of effective decoherence. This is very recent, and I have done, this is also, is not in the paper I'm referring to, I've done a very, very recent calculation on this. And then we'll generalize this to some other kinds of inequalities, in particular, Merlin inequalities, and later we'll consider a higher spin. So not only violation of Merlin inequalities with spin one half particles, but with larger and hypothetically macroscopic spins, and we'll see how this can be connected to classicality. And then we'll make some conclusions. So to start with, I would like just to give an idea. Whenever we talk about where we don't have a reference frame, to give some operational meaning to this, an easy way is to think about what can we do when we make some communication without a shared reference frame. So as an example, suppose that we have an Anisimov, and suppose that they want to communicate a direction. So Bob prepares an arrow pointing to a specific direction, and he wants to communicate this to Alice. But they don't share a reference frame. So if Bob tries to send directly the arrow he was using to define the directions, Alice cannot know anything, because this can be any arbitrary angle. Because there, in a way, the channel of communication, there is a noise that completely mix the directional information. So what can Bob do? Bob can send the reference frame together with the system he prepared. And in this case, if you have two classical systems, of course you can send exactly the relative angle. So in general, we call a relative state what you can prepare and measure without an external reference frame. And without external reference frame, as we may run into subtleties, we always think of this communication scheme, so without a shared reference frame. So just to give some formalization of what you're talking about, very generally, how do we formalize a reference frame? So in general, we can say that whenever we make a transformation of reference frame, we act as a passive transformation on some physical state. So for example, we make a rotation, and our state is transformed. So very, very generally, we can think of a reference frame as characterized by some group. Because transformation of a reference frame, of course, form a group. And so for example, you can have a group of rotation, or the covering SE2. Or a group of translation, a group of boost, and etc. And this is what we think is characterizing a specific reference frame. And while the system itself is generally characterized by some representation of the reference frame of the group, because of course if you have the same if you consider the same transformation of reference frame but different systems, they can in general transform according to different norms. And so, for example, you can have different spins, of course, they transform differently among the same reference frame transformation. So now, as we want to talk about quantum reference frame, as we said, we think about quantum reference frame as what you can do when you don't have an external reference frame. So first of all, we want to know what can we say when we don't have an external reference frame. So suppose we have a density matrix rho, and we don't have a reference frame. So for example, I send a state, and the receiver doesn't share any reference frame with me. So the best you can do to describe a state will be some average, some uncoherent average with respect to all the reference frame transformation. This uncoherent average is called the Turing operator. And to get some feeling of how it works, we have that every hyperspace, if you consider general hyperspace and a group that acts on it, we have generally this this structure where the hyperspace is divided in subspaces, and in each subspace we have an irreducible representation and some multiplicity space. So what does this means that the groups act as an irreducible representation on M and acts as an identity on N. And you can add these for many subspaces. So what does the Turing operator do? The Turing operator projects on each of these subspaces. Then as you are making an average over all the possible transformation of reference frame, the average only acts on M, that is where the group action is non-trivial, and is identity over the multiplicity subspace. So this is quite formal to give some intuition of so for example, Q can be total spin. And this is a very general structure that you can see also in for the coherence, you can see for super selection rule, and the analogy is the LQ spaces are the coherence full subspaces, and LQ are the coherence free So to get some insight of what does it mean in our specific case, consider three spin-on half particles. So we have three spin-on half particles and we have no external reference frame. What can we measure of them? What can we measure is the total spin of any subset. So we can take any pair of them, and of course the total spin can be 0, 1, or we can measure the total spin of all of three. And the total spin can be 1 half or 3 half. But of course we can also have a pair of spin in a definite total spin state and have and also measure the total spin. And so generally if the first two pair adds up to total spin 1, if all the three spins have a total spin 3 halves, then that means that the first two must have a spin 1, because right, if you take two together and then make one and then you take the third, it can make 3 halves. If you take them together and then make 0, there is no way that it will make 3 halves. And so in this case, what we call the clearance full subspace is the subspace corresponding to the total spin, while the multiplicity space is the subspace corresponding to the spin of some subset. So this is more clear if we consider total spin 1 half. Can you get this? You can, as we said, you can get having the first two added, making total spin 0, and then the third one adding and making 1 half. Or you can have the first two making total spin 1, and the third one makes 1 half. So you get them anti-aligned, and you get the third one. So this means that if you have total spin 1 half, there are two ways to build this, and this corresponds to this multiplicity subspace. So if you are making these rotational invariant measurements, you can still measure all these degrees of freedom. And actually, you cannot measure anything but that. So, very generally, the action of this twirling operator is to wash out all the information that is not this.
I didn't understand why one was the coherence full and the other one the coherence free. So it's very.
So. So this is the coherence full because it is the irreducible representation. So I have that with example. So suppose that the three spins have total spin 3 halves. Then you can have the component can have four different values. The component along the z direction can be minus 3 halves, minus 1 half, plus 1 half of plus 3 halves. But if you are measuring making rotation invariant measurement, you cannot measure this component. Mm-hmm. So you have to completely mix over this subspace. I can tell you the total spin is 3 halves, but I can tell you nothing about what is the component. So this is why this is the coherence full subspace. So I take the whole spin and I consider.
Yeah, but you wrote them as a tensor product, which means that they are not subspaces. So the
Yes. So this represents the coherence full subspace because you cannot measure the component. So you can think I have the three particles. I consider them now as a global system. Suppose that I found that they are of total spin 3 halves, and now I cannot know what is the component. So when I'm saying I have a rotation invariant measurement, I have to mix among the degrees of freedom of this subspace, not subspace, of this subsystem. But if I consider what are the possibilities to build these 3 halves, this can be either making 0 or making 1. Of course, this is just one choice of the basis. But still, and this is not affected by your twirling map. Because I can still measure if the first pair had the total spin 0 or total spin 1. So this is the coherence free because you have 2 degrees of freedom and it still takes 2 degrees of freedom. So,
right. Okay. So in that equation, you have a sum first of products. So
yes,
the sum would be 3 halves and 1 half in this case.
Yes, exactly.
And the two products are in this. Okay.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Okay.
So, finally, what are then the quantum reference frames? So, as we said, a quantum reference frame, we call a quantum reference frame a state that is a quantum system, and we use to determine the state of another quantum system that we consider now the system. And we are in a situation where it is globally, we don't have another external reference frame. So, consider now a spin 1/2 particle. If we have a spin 1/2 particle, what we can do with an external reference frame is to measure its projection along a given direction. And so, for example, we can send it to a Stern-Gerlach magnet and see whether it is a spin up or spin down. So, what can we do with a quantum reference frame? We can take as a, for example, a very useful state that we can use as a quantum reference frame is a coherent state. So a coherent state is the one that has a minimal uncertainty along a given direction. So we can think it as an around that points in one direction with some uncertainty, in this case as a square root of j, where j is the total spin. So now we have our spin 1/2 particle, our coherent state of length j, and we want to know what is the orientation of the particle along the coherent state. So we want to use this spin coherent state as if it was the reference frame, so the direction of our spherical element. So what we can do, as we said, we can measure total angular momentum, because as we said, this is the only measurement we can do without an external reference frame. And so what we can get is j plus 1 as total angular momentum, or j minus 1. And so, if we want to see in this representation of before, we don't have this multiplicity subspace because we are using only two systems. So this is pretty simple in that point of view. We have just a spin j particle, a spin 1/2 particle, and they can have up to j plus 1 or minus 1. And so, now we want to interpret in this way. We can say, if we find j plus 1 alpha, we can say, okay, the spin was up, was pointing along the direction of the coherent state. If we have j minus 1 half, we can say the spin was down, because we can say they subtract. But, when we do that, we always introduce an error. Because whenever we say, whenever we say j plus 1 half, and we associate this aligned possibility, we have always this state that that is a total spin j 1 half, j plus 1 half, but component along z direction j minus 1 half. So if we had an external reference frame, we could measure this component, and we would see that we have measured something that is anti-aligned. But the total spin is j plus 1 half, so we interpret it as aligned, and so of course we introduce an error. And as this is the optimal procedure to estimate what is the relative orientation, this is the best we can do, and so we will always introduce an error when we use the quantum reference frame. And what is nice is that if the size of the coherent state goes to infinity, the probability for this wrong guess goes to zero. And so we can say that a very large coherent state is like a classical reference frame, which is of course something we would like to recover. So of course this can be generalized when we measure a spin j particle, a spin js particle with the spin j with some other reference frame, and we have m outcomes. I will not spend too much time on this. We can see this as an effective POVM measurement on the spin. So if you have the classical reference frame, you can have 2j plus 1 components for measuring the spin j particles. Here also you have 2j plus 1 components, but what you're measuring is effectively a POVM, and the different elements are not orthogonal, are not orthogonal projectors. So that's how you can see that you are introducing some error, because you're not making a projective measurement. And of course, for the reference frame that goes to infinity, this tends to the projective measurement. So this was the brief introduction, was not very brief, on reference frame. And so what did we apply this for? So as we said, we want to know how the use of this quantum reference frame affects the quantum properties of system. And quantum properties we are interested in is specifically entanglement. So we consider first Bell inequality in the GHSH form. So we know that from Bell theorem that if you build a local realistic, a locally invariable model, and you build up so you build up the correlation functions of you have so you have two observers, Alice and Bob, and each of them can they share a single fate, and each of them can make can measure along the different directions, and they can build up correlation functions. So this is the correlation functions of Alice measuring along set in two, and Bob measuring along set in two. Bell theorem tells us that if you for any local realistic model, you cannot have this quantity larger than 2. So in our setting, the direction along which Alice and Bob are measuring are replaced by coherent states pointing along specific directions. The measurement of the projective measurement along this direction is replaced by the measurement of total angular momentum, as we say. And so what we want to know is what happened. What we expect is that the ability to violate will decrease if they use a smaller reference frame. And indeed, if you calculate the correlation functions in the classical case, you have that the correlation function simply depends on the angle between the two settings that you're using. While if you're using the coherent state, what we find is that you have this J dependent terms in front of it. And you can see that if J is infinity, you can see that you correctly have this limit. So again, we recover the classical situation. But if J is smaller, these correlation functions are smaller. So the ability to see correlations depends on the reference frame that we're using. And then this GHSH quantity has this form. And again, you can see, I think, that if J1 and J2 go to infinity, this goes to 2 square root of 2, which is the maximum violation you can expect in the classical case. But if J1 and J2 are finite, these will be always smaller. And so our what is interesting is that we want to know what must be the size of the reference frame for which we still can violate the inequality. And the answer, this is just some magical number, is 5.5. So it's it means that already with a spin coherent state that is you can think as a build up of 5 spins, you can already violate the inequalities. If you have a coherent state, if you have a reference frame that is smaller than this, then you will never be able to violate the inequalities. And so effectively, you won't be able to distinguish between your single state as a quantum state and from some local realistic description. So you can build up your experiment and can give a perfectly fine local realistic, local hidden variable description of your experiment.
What about 1J smaller and 1 larger?
Sorry?
So what about 1J smaller and 1 larger?
Yes, so if you take them, now, so you can have one as smaller, so you can never have one smaller than 3 halves. So if you take one infinite, the other one cannot be smaller than 3 alpha. So yeah, this is quite interesting because it really depends on both sides. It doesn't matter if one size is very larger. Of course, if one size is larger, you can make the other smaller, but not as small as T1 alpha. And I think, now I don't remember exactly, but I think the limit is that if you have 3 halves, you must have 11 halves as the larger one. But of course, you can play with this. Okay, any other questions so far? So the interesting, as you said, the interesting result is that you need some minimal reference frame. And what was a little surprising for us at the beginning is that it is so small. So it is quite intuitive that if you use this quantum state as a reference frame, you lose the ability of seeing quantum effects. Because as we said, the intuition goes like this, that if I have a spin coherent state pointing along Z, then and I measure it along Y, I still have some probability of finding it along Y. So I cannot really say my coherent state is pointing along Z, because with some probability is also pointing along Y. So our coherent state are only approximately direction indicators. So now, this is something that it's quite new. I didn't have much feedback about this, so you're welcome to criticize what I'm about to say. So what is a little annoying in this talk about reference frame is that you always have to consider the reference frame together with the system. So when you write down quantum mechanics or any other theory that you write with respect to some external reference frame, you don't bother to write explicitly what is the physical state that represents my direction, what is the physical state that represents my positions, my reference frame, etc. So we would like to know if it is possible to give some effective descriptions to of the system when a quantum reference frame is used. And the answer is a big yes, and it's a very recent work. One can implement an effective coherence map that describes what is your state when you are using quantum reference frame. So basically is this map with some subtlety when you are using directional indicator, but we don't care about that now. So what you see is that whenever we have a state, so consider we have a pure state, and we are using only bounded reference frame. What you see that is that this state gets a little mixed. And so we have a term that that is proportional to the entity, and is the leading term when J goes to infinity. So again, when J is very large, we recover this becomes just the density map, so nothing happens. But when J is very small, this term start being important, and this is the Q-ring operator we were discussing about. So the one that completely mixes, completely averages for reference frame transformation. So you have that, you have your state gets, is effectively is like having some noise. You have some state, you measure with the quantum reference frame, and effectively is having some noise. So, and now we can ask, can we directly apply this to our case? So to our example of evaluating the inequalities. And what just found out, I was doing the calculation on the bus trip from New York to here, and is that yes, you can apply, but the result is not exactly the same. So this is something not completely clear, and just to give you a sketch of what is the calculation like, you take a single state, and then you're saying that both Alice and Bob have no absolute reference frame, but only quantum reference frame. So at least as I understand it, you have to apply one decoherence map on each side. And what you get is you transform the original state to this one. So again, you see that if J is very small, you are going closer to the identity, so to a more mixed state. And then you again calculate the correlation function, and as you see, it's not the same as before. So just to remind you briefly. So the correlation function I had found before was this, to bring the explicit calculation. While with this new method, is actually is much, much nicer, because it's a simpler formula. It's just the usual correlation function with this factor in front of it. And if you, again, want the CHSH quantity, is 2 square root of 2 with the same factor in front of it. And what you find is that if you do in this way, the minimal reference frame is larger. So you want to know what is the J1 and J2 such that you still violate the inequality, so that this S is larger than 2, and you find 11 hours. So this is quite interesting, because to me it means that it's not so trivial to try to really get rid of this reference frame, because when we use it explicitly, we find another result. So one possible interpretation is that in our case, we are using this reference frame with some definite angle between them. So this coherent state has some definite angle, and then Alice and Bob just make a rotation invariant measurement. While probably if you use this approach, it's more that Alice and Bob receive a part of the simple state and the coherent state, and then after this they perform a transformation of the coherent state, a rotation of the coherent state to decide the directions. And this gives a different result. So the message of this is whenever you start to apply to composite system, this effective reference frame map, things are at least to me not yet so clear. Question on this?
The reason could be that it's the effective decoherence we calculated was not necessarily the minimal decoherence. So we had a particular scheme for decoding, which gave us an effective decoherence. And it wasn't necessarily the optimal decoding scheme.
But wasn't it still a measuring of total angular momentum?
It was more than just a measurement of total angular momentum, because you had to resolve inside the decoherence-free subsystem. So I'd have to think about it more carefully, but I think that perhaps there's no inconsistency because the effective decoherence map is not the least decoherent.
I'm sure there is no inconsistency, because either some of the calculations are wrong or they are right. I mean, assuming that all the calculations are right, they simply represent different physical situations. I'm not sure. I think it's pretty much the same. What you say is that you try to reconstruct the state during this. Well, we don't do that. We just measure total angular momentum. So this can be the reason. But then, I mean, that would be a little disappointing, because one would like to really use this to say, okay, we now forget about all the coherent state, all the stuff, and we just apply the coherence map. I'm not sure. I think it's really something I did very recently. But yeah, I would like to understand this better. So next step. So now that we learned how to do this game, we apply this to more general settings, and I'll try not to spend too much time on this. So we consider Mervyn's inequality. So what's the game now? We have n speed-1/2 particles that are sent to n observers. And like before, every observer measure along two possible settings. And then again, you can build some local realistic bound. So you can build some inequality that is violated for a quantum system, but never violated by classical systems. This is quite awkward expression, but what is important is that here we have the n-body correlation function. So here we have the settings that are used by each observer. Each observer can choose by two, and then when they make their measurement, they calculate correlations between all the possibilities. So, for example, I have three observers, and each of them can measure along two directions, and so we will have eight possibilities, so plus, 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 minus, etc. And then you calculate whenever whenever they get the product is plus, you add this with plus in the correlation function, whenever the product is minus, you add the probability with minus in the correlation function. And so you can build n parametric correlation functions, and then you build up this inequality that is simply you are summing all these correlation functions with some plus and some minus and some zero. The analog of our single state is the GH set state. So for this state, you can maximally violate this inequality. And what is interesting is that the violation is exponential. So if you use this state, you can reach for this quantity 2 to the power n minus 1. That is exponentially larger than the local realistic bound. The interesting thing is also that if you remove one of the particles, only one, then you completely lose the entanglement. So you don't recover this. So what is interesting at applying a bounded preference frame is to see, so we can expect that using more and more particles, you can use smaller and smaller reference frames. But also the fact that just losing one completely meets your state, I mean, you completely lose the inequality, tells you that you will probably not be able to use arbitrarily small reference frame. So for n classical reference frame, as you said, this can go up to n 2 to the power n. And if you use a coherent state, you have the same with this J-dependent factor in front of it. So if you use all equal reference frame, the minima that you can use is 3 halves. So this is again interesting because one could expect that for n going to infinity, the minimal reference frame could be enough, but it's not true. You still need at least 3 halves. And then you can ask, what if I have some classical reference frame and some very small reference frame? And what you can see is that you can still have a half classical reference frame and half still one alpha, and still violate the inequality. And what is nice is that in all cases the violation is exponential. So it's you have of course lower and lower violation, but whenever you have some violation, this is exponential. So this is a next step to improve our understanding of how quantum reference frame affects entanglement. And the last one is Perez inequalities, and this maybe is somehow more interesting. So in this case, we consider an arbitrary large thing. So we have again two parties, and they share the partial state of two spin particle which have spin j, so not just spin one alpha, spin j, and they are in some state that it is some generalized single state. So how do you build Bell inequalities in this case? To build Bell inequalities, you have to make a still binary measurement, and the binary measurement used here is parity. So whenever you measure the component along some direction, and whenever the component is odd, you say, okay, my measurement is 1. Whenever the component is even, you say minus 1. Or, yeah, the other way around. It's the same. And so this is again a bipartite measurement, and you can build a very inequality measuring along different directions. So again, the local realistic bound is 2, as before. And what is interesting is that the choice of setting depends now on the size of the reference frame. So when you use a depends on the size of the spin, not of the reference frame. When you use a larger and larger spin, you have to use settings that are closer and closer together. And so we can expect that we will need larger and larger reference frame to see this variation, because to distinguish angles that are very close together, that are very small, we need we can expect to need a larger reference frame, because a reference frame, as you said, has some it's like having some uncertainty, and as the reference frame is smaller, the uncertainty is larger. So so as we said, the required precision is scales as 1/j, and so this is some we can make some intuitive argument to see how is the scaling of the reference frame size with the spin with the system size. So as we said, the reference frame has an uncertainty in a direction that is proportional to square root of j. We have to measure with a precision that is 1/j, and so if you put this together, you get that you should use a quantum reference frame that are at least quadratically in the spin. So this is very heuristic argument, but we did in this case it is a numerical calculation, and we get so here we have the size of the spin, and here we have the size of the reference frame, and these points are the minimal reference frame you need to violate the inequalities. So as you make the system spin larger, you need a larger and larger reference frame. And we did some quadratic fit, and we see that is pretty good. So this reinforces our intuition, our heuristic argument. So and the interesting result is this, that the reference frame must scale, must be for large system, the reference frame must be much larger. And so, for example, so this is the result in this case, but we can try to extrapolate and conjecture how this can work for other possible systems. So consider this situation. You have a typical decoherence picture. You have some quantum state, some maybe macroscopic, some quantum state that is measured or that anyway decoheres, interacts with the environment. And so the coherence. So a typical problem of the decoherence picture is that after the coherence takes place, you still have a lot of entanglement between the system and the environment. And so in principle, you cannot say that the system is really classical, because you still have all this entanglement with the environment. But so if we try to extrapolate from our result, we can ask what is the reference frame we need to measure this entanglement in the environment. And so if it is true that the reference frame is quadratically larger than the system, that in this case is a bigger environment, we can guess that in practical situation you will never realize this. And so we have that as long as we consider only relational properties, this big entanglement between the system and the environment doesn't have any operational sense, because unless you have a very, very strong and larger measuring apparatus to detect this entanglement, you will never detect this.
So by large, you really mean the dimensionality of the Hilbert
space? In this case, yes. In this case, dimension of Hilbert space.
Well,
you like this?
No, it can be very high, usually, the dimensionality of the Hilbert.
Yes, that's why you don't, I mean, if you have some environment, the dimension of the Hilbert space is very large. And so if you want to use a reference frame, I mean, if you want to detect this entanglement, you need a reference frame that has a dimensionality much larger, quadratically larger. And so if you have 10 to the 23 particles involved in this entanglement, you will need 10 to the 46 particles that are completely screened. And I mean, this is all the optimal procedure. So if you don't have at least 10 to the 46 particles that you can use as reference frame, you will never be able to detect any quantum behavior in this environment. So effectively, it's like saying there is no entanglement left. Okay, so we're about to finish. What we can say finally is that if you use a quantum bounded reference frame, your ability to observe quantum behavior, and specifically violation of local realistic bounds, is limited. As not specification, we talk about bounded reference frame, because if you have a quantum system that is not bounded, so it's of an infinite dimension, you still can use it as a perfect reference frame. An example is taking our clear state with j that goes to infinity. If j goes to infinity, you can use this as a classical reference frame. So everything comes out whenever you use finite dimensional systems. The main result is that if you try to violate change of state inequality, the length of the reference frame must be at least 5/2. And for exponential violation, you still need some reference frame that is larger than 3/2. So as we say that if you have if you lose one particle in your GHS set state, if you have this n particle entangled state, and you lose one, that is equivalent to say you have no reference frame. You completely you make a random guess on the result of it. If you lose one, you completely miss. You are not able to see entanglement. But also, if you have a classical reference frame everywhere, and you have less than 3/2, so you have very small but not trivial reference frame, you're still not able. You still need some of the reference frame at least 3/2. And the final about Peres inequalities is that the scaling of the reference frame size with the system size must be at least quadratic. So the final remark, I mean, this is still, again, it's conjecture because this will be used as a toy model. But we can summarize our conjecture like this. If you have a large system and a reference frame that is still large, but not much larger, so again, more or less the same size, you cannot see quantum effects. And so you can imagine this as explaining how relational properties of macroscopic objects never show quantum features. If you have a small system, a large reference frame, you can indeed see quantum features, and this is the situation of usual quantum experiments, where you have very small system and very big apparatuses. And then we have the situation of small systems and a small reference frame. And if the reference frame is too small, again, you don't see quantum features, and this is somehow a different regime from those usually known. And so there are some works, very speculative work in a way, trying to connect this with gravity. And this is really, really speculative. But that if you really believe that you should to implement general relativity in quantum mechanics, you should use relative states between quantum objects, and when you go to very small scales and you consider relative quantities between very small systems, then you will not see quantum features. And this is very, very speculative, but maybe it's some new regime that can be explored. And that's it.
Questions?
Okay, concerning whether you could see some quantum effects for macroscopic systems.
Yep.
So you're looking at only certain degrees of freedom of your macroscopic systems, the collective rotational degrees of freedom.
Yes.
But if instead you looked at relational degrees of freedom of that composite system, then you could see quantum effects.
So you mean if I consider it not as a single spin J particle, but as a build up from many.
Right. So one example would be if I have 3 spin halves
mm-hmm.
and 3 spin halves that are entangled, then each of them have a two-dimensional decoherence-free subsystem.
Yes.
And so I can prepare entanglement. And then to do measurements and see Bell-Ecoli violations, I don't need any external reference frame on either side because they're invariant degrees of freedom.
Yes, good point. So in our idea, so indeed the point is that in this case you are not really using the macroscopic system. You are using some properties of microscopic properties of the composite system, right?
Well, what I wonder is whether you could, if you have a truly macroscopic composite system, then rather than looking at its orientation space, maybe you can look at some relational degrees of freedom. and have those also be macroscopic. Mm-hmm. So maybe divide it up into macroscopic subsystems and look at the relations among the macroscopic subsystems, or something like that.
Right. So the point, yeah, that's true. The point is that you will need a lot of, so to measure this, you will need to build up a lot of entanglement, I guess. So to measure this relation on the subsystems. So in our picture, you're really trying to look at microscopic properties. And I don't see how you can call these relational properties how they can be really microscopic. I'm not sure about that. That's a very good point. But it's not really the situation where you have two big entangled systems. I mean, somehow you're playing with these internal degrees of freedom. I think it's not exactly the same, but yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Yes.